Bookcasers, it is Thursday, and that means one thing. It means that you are sat down and giving us your full attention. It is The Bookcase with Kate and Charlie, and I am Kate.
And I am Charlie, and you can hear way back in the background. I can hear it back in your living room. Your Alexa device, your Siri device, it's saying to you, it's time for The Bookcase. Put everything down. Listen to Kate and Charlie. And if that's not going on, well, we're glad you're with us anyway. enough of this palaver. We have Tana French with us. Tana French is such a wonderful writer. I always think the Irish have it in their DNA that they're great writers. Well, she's is an immigrant to Ireland. So I think it's something in the water that makes her such a wonderful writer. But the Dublin Murder series, the Dublin Murder Squad, I think there's six of those novels. She wrote a novel that was very successful a couple of years ago called The Searcher. And now she's written a companion piece called The Hunter.
Yeah, she does a beautiful job, I think, of showing you some of the darkness of small town living, especially the darkness of small town living in Ireland. One of the things I really enjoy about The Searcher and this one, new one, The Hunter specifically, is I think sometimes Americans look at Ireland and they think of, it's cute, it's quaint, it's four-leaf clovers, it's jigs, it's Lord of the Dance.
It's leprechauns.
Yes, exactly. It's leprechauns and cute accents. And Cal Hooper, who is an American, a displaced retired policeman who moves to Ireland, is in a sense charmed by Ireland. And that's why he chooses to go there when he doesn't want to be a cop anymore. And yet, as he comes to the small town of Ardnakelty, he starts to see that this town is darker, more complex. Relationships go back generations. You know, his cute neighbor who stops by for a little chat, maybe saying more in that little chat than you might think. And she does a brilliant job, I think, of bringing all of that home.
Yeah, there's a sort of ominous undertone to the people of Ardnakelty. And you saw that in the first book, but you don't need to have read The Searcher to read this continuation, The Hunter. I read it without having read The Searcher before. I was perfectly comfortable with it. There was one small part that I said, why is that? But it didn't bother me in the least. But she does. She sees a sort of dark undercurrent. And as you'll hear in our conversation, she likes taking the conventional wisdom and sort of flipping it on its back and looking for something different. And as I say, there's a sort of dark undertone to Ardnakelty and to the people of Ardnakelty. But we should give you a little bit of the plot because we talk about it. Cal Hooper is still here. He was the Chicago policeman, as Kate mentions, that came to Ardnakelty in The Searcher. And he takes under his wing a sort of feral teenager, Trey. She's back in this book, central character. And he has developed a relationship with Lena, who's a woman in town. And two people come back to town, as they say on the cover of the book. And they bring with them a con job. They try to convince the people of Ardnakelty that there's gold underneath their feet and that they all should invest. And you think, well, this is a scam novel, as these two men try to get some money out of the people of Ardnakelty. And then at, what, page 200 or so, it flips into a murder mystery. And it says right on the cover, these two men came back to Ardnakelty and one of them came to die. Well,
dun, dun, dun.
Right. That sort of brings you in. And but doesn't die until later. And then all of a sudden, the scam novel becomes a murder mystery. And she pulls off both, I think.
She does. I think what's great about the book, too, is that when the body shows up as late as it does in the game, you think to yourself, oh, yeah, there's a body. Like, it's been a page turner up until that point. I'd sort of forgotten that nobody was dead. And then somebody died. And I thought, oh, yeah, somebody has to die. She does this very, very well. And we really enjoyed our conversation. Our conversation with Tana French. Tana French, it is such an honor to have you in The Bookcase. I've been a fan for so long. And I think my first question for you is, Americans have a very definitive picture of Ireland, and largely it's cute, you know, and quaint. And there's nothing quaint and cute about the small town that you've written about. So what I want to know is, do you sometimes set out to knock that stereotype off of Americans' ledge and say, hey, we're not just cute. There's some darkness here as well.
We're definitely not 100% cute. Listen, thank you so much for having me before anything else. It's not exactly so much that I set out to knock the stereotype down. It's that I love things with layers. I really like the fact that whatever place you come to, you get an initial impression of it. And then the longer you're there, the more the layers get peeled away. And the more you see that, especially in a place where it's small, people know each other really well, relationships go back generations, things are complicated. Relationships are complicated. Everything that happens is more intricate than it looks.
This is a companion novel to The Searcher, a companion piece, I guess. But, and I admit I had not read it until I read this one, and I didn't feel as I went through that I needed to read The Searcher, but is it necessary?
No, I don't think you need to read The Searcher before reading this one. They're set in the same world, and they're both kind of that like mystery software running on Western hardware kind of vibe, but they're very separate books. The Searcher is about one guy, Cal Hooper, this retired Chicago detective coming to the west of Ireland looking for peace and quiet and, you know, obviously not finding it. But The Hunter is about three people. It's about Cal and his girlfriend Lena and this sort of half-feral teenager Trey, whom they're trying to raise into a good kid going good places. And so it's from three perspectives because it is about the relationship, and the book doesn't take place in any one person's world. It takes place in the space between the three of them.
One of the principal characters is the town in Western Ireland, Ard na Chealta, a name I love, and that's where it takes place. I saw that you readily adopted the characterization of the book being an Irish Western. What does that mean? What does that mean to you?
I had just discovered the whole Western genre. Somehow I had missed it my whole life. And then someone whose taste I trust recommended Lonesome Dove. And oh man, what a book. Just what a book. And then, you know, that was the gateway drug. And then I was reading True Grit and The Sisters Brothers and other Westerns and going, look at all these tropes and look how well they'd map onto the west of Ireland. Because the settings have a lot in common. You've got this wild, harsh beauty that demands serious physical and mental toughness from anyone who wants to earn a living from it. And you've also got that sense of a place that is so distant from the centers of power, both geographically and culturally. The people living there feel like the power brokers don't care about them and don't understand their way of life. And if they want a cohesive society, a functional society, they're going to have to make their own rules and enforce them themselves. So I started thinking, what would Western tropes look like if I transposed them onto that setting? In The Hunter, I was thinking more about the gold rush trope. You know how Westerns always have, there's gold in them there hills? And I thought, weirdly, you don't think of that being an Irish thing, but it kind of fits because there are loads of ancient gold artifacts that have been found in Ireland. And there have been mini gold rushes through the centuries, even up to quite recently. You've got people hunting for gold in the mountains. So I thought, well, that would actually make a certain amount of sense.
After you got fascinated by the Western genre, did that guide your development of Cal Hooper? How did you make Cal Hooper into your out-of-town cowboy, as it were?
Oh yeah, no, definitely that was part of it, because I'd just come off writing The Witch Elm, which is a really introspective book. Mm. Like the main focus of the action is inside the narrator's head. And while that was interesting to write, by the very end of it, I was going, oh my God, I'm so sick of this guy's thinking all the time. He needs to pull his head out of his rear end and go do stuff. That kind of fit in really well with Westerns, where the characters are always focused on action. Mm. So I was writing it, obviously, a protagonist who had to fit into that, which was exactly what I wanted to write. So Cal is somebody who basically lives by the belief that it doesn't really matter what you think. It matters what you do. You can think as virtuously as you want, but that counts for nothing if you aren't doing the right thing. And that's what he tries to do all the way. And that's kind of why the novel's in third person, because from his perspective, what's inside his head doesn't really matter that much. It's what he does that matters.
Trey's long absent father comes back to town and is trying to convince the town that there is gold underneath their feet. So it starts as a scam novel, a con job, and then it morphs into a murder mystery. I'm wondering, did you start knowing that that was going to happen, or did the story sort of take over and you let it drift into not only a scam novel, but a murder mystery as well?
I knew somebody was going to wind up dead here, and I had a fair idea of who when I was starting. The con job was sort of accidental. But when I was thinking about Cal and Trey's relationship, how new it is and how delicate at this point, and I started thinking, what would happen if something happened to disrupt that balance before it had time to solidify? And the obvious thing was, they're developing a sort of pseudo father-daughter relationship. What if her actual father shows up and wants to use her for his own purposes? And just once Johnny was in it, Trey's bio father, he was the kind of guy who was always going to come home with a con job.
I know better than to pigeonhole a talented writer, but people think of you as a murder mystery writer. There's no body until page 276, and it's still a page turner up until that point. Did you ever think to yourself, this is kind of risky, I'm not showing a body until 276?
Yeah, I kind of did. I was going, oh God, this is meant to be a mystery. And here we go. And we're like 2/3 of the way through the book and nobody's dead. That can't be right. But I figured, I've always thought with mysteries, both the ones I write and my favorite ones that I read, the big mystery is not whodunit. The big mystery is what's going on in people's heads. How do they interact? What brings them to the point where somebody ends up dead? And you can do that retroactively, the way you do in most mysteries, where you dump in the body at the beginning and then you pick out the reasons why that body's there over the course of the book. But I figured probably you can make it work the other way around, where slowly the reasons why this person gets killed build and knit themselves together, and then, boom, you've got the dead person. Mm.
You mentioned the three characters, the principals, Cal, Lena, and Trey. But one of the characters that fascinated me was Mart Lavin, who sort of embodied to me Ard na Cailte, the town.
He's so much fun to write. He is so much fun to write because he does kind of personify one of the elements of the Irish way of communication, which is that a lot of time stuff is not communicated directly. You go around it and you just touch on it very tangentially and very subtly, and you may work your way closer and closer until the person you're communicating with picks up what you're communicating. And Mart's a great opportunity to bring that to life.
But that presents an interesting challenge as a writer. If you are writing a character and you're writing events, you're writing lots of characters where what goes unsaid is probably more important than what is said. How do you approach that when you're writing dialogue and writing character description? How do you do that?
It's a weird juggling act where you're keeping in mind every single character's different agenda and their lens on the situation and their place in the hierarchy all at once. It's a lot of fun, actually, when you're writing big group scenes, because you have to have everybody floating around your head at once. And occasionally you'll go back and go, oh my God, this guy has completely got lost. I forgot he was even there. He probably has something to say at this point right here. So it's complicated. It's a juggling act, but it's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
You talked about Mart Lavin as somebody who typifies perhaps some people in Ireland who you have to interpret, that you can't take literally from what they say. Kate can relate to that. She lives in Minnesota. Minnesota
really?
Nice is is kind of, you have to take things on two different levels. But we think of the Irish Blarney, and we think of the fact that they're all talkers. They're all great talkers. Fair or not fair?
It's currency around here. Good conversation is one of the major forms of currency. And it is great to be around. It's one of the things I love about being here. It's just the creativity as well with language, not just how much the banter has to be fast and flow and keep going, but also the insults here are incredibly creative. I love them. I don't take my characters from life. I don't take settings from life, but I absolutely steal phrases. Like a few weeks back, I heard someone say, Jesus, he's got a face on him like a melted welly. And I was like, right, I'm using that. Somehow I'm going to find a way to use that.
I'm interested in something that you said just now, which is that Cal Hooper and his books in some ways were reactions to The Witch Elm. Is that sort of a process for you where you finish a book and you go, I need to write the exact opposite of what I just wrote? Is that what guides you to either The Dublin Murder Squad or Cal Hooper or a standalone?
A lot of the time, I think it's because there's a point around three quarters of the way through a book, right, where my mind suddenly starts wanting to do absolutely anything else. I don't know what this is, but it's like, oh God, I should really clear out the attic. Maybe I should brush the cat. But luckily for me, one of the ways my mind tries to distract me from finishing the current book is by coming up with ideas for the next one, which is at least useful, and going, oh, you should write about this instead. This is going to be so much more interesting than whatever you're currently working on. So that's, I think, generally what happens is something quite different gets bounced up, like with The Murder Squad, which are a chain linked set of books where a supporting character from one becomes the narrator in the next. What was happening is I'd get three quarters of the way into one guy's book and my brain would start going, you know what? He's boring. This guy over here is way more interesting. You should write about him. I'd have to deal with that.
I like that idea, by the way. It's a way of keeping you writing. It's a way of keeping you enthusiastic. It's like, I've got this thing waiting in the wings when I go crazy on this one.
You're a trained actress. So what made you turn to writing?
Well, writing was kind of there first. When I was a little kid, I was always going to write. And then I got sidetracked, I guess, by acting for a while. But they're not really that different, especially if you're writing either first person or close third person. What you're doing is you're trying to create a character who's complex and three-dimensional and vividly real to your audience and bring them in so that they see the whole world of this story through that character's biases and fears and objectives. And that's very much the same thing that you do both as an actor and as a writer. You want to bring your audience so close to this character that they feel like they know this person intimately, inside out. So it's not a big leap. It really isn't.
But as an actress, you're trying to convey through somebody else's words, whereas a writer, you have control over everything. I would think control would be something that would really make writing more appealing.
It, not control in that sense. Like, I love both in kind of different ways, but to me, they both come down to the character and you getting out of the way to give the character space. But control in another way. As an actor, right, you are dependent on somebody else's permission to work, unless you're one of those actors who can set up a theater company, make your own work. And as a writer, one of the most liberating discoveries when I started writing in the woods was that I wasn't dependent on anyone's permission. All I needed was a pen and a notebook, and nobody could stop me doing this. It was amazing. I still appreciate it.
To your mind, what makes a great mystery? Mm. What is the absolute essential part of a mystery?
Oh, I love the mysteries that start with the genre boundaries and then play with them. Turn them inside out so that they say something new about the characters or about some theme or about the world. Like if you take The Secret History, for example, which is a great literary novel, but it is also a great mystery. It's a great murder mystery, except that on the first page, she breaks the cardinal rule and tells you who killed whom. On page one, in the first paragraph, basically. And she's taking all the genre conventions and just smashing them wide open, exploding them and putting the bits together to form something entirely new. And I love the mysteries that do that, that take all those conventions as starting points, not rules.
This is a wonderful book. We have both enjoyed it, both loved it, and both thought, gee, wouldn't it be fun to talk to Tana French? Thank you ever so much. We're going to ask you to stand by for just a moment and we'll ask you some rapid fire questions.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Rapid fire questions for Tana French. Dickens or Shakespeare?
Oh, Shakespeare, all the way.
Poirot or Holmes?
Poirot.
Do you finish books you aren't liking?
Usually, not always.
What will make you put a book down?
If I find myself arguing with it because I think it's so stupid, we're done for everybody's health.
If I'm an aspiring mystery writer, whose work should I study?
Agatha Christie for a perfect adherence to the genre conventions, and Patricia Highsmith for layers of psychological depth, and Josephine Tay for playing with all the conventions and more modern ones. Oh God, where do I start? I can't stop. Kate Atkinson and Donna Tartt and Dennis Lehane. Dennis Lehane for bringing in huge amounts of social history and the entire community into a mystery novel, and Michael Chabon, because he does all of it at once with wonderful language and wonderful characters, an entire alternate history universe. And if you don't stop me, I'm going to keep going.
Favorite book to read to your kids was?
Mo Willems, Elephant and Piggy, I Will Surprise My Friend. It still cracks me up.
Love that book.
An Irish writer that Americans should know better, but don't.
Donal Ryan. He is absolutely wonderful.
What would you start with?
Start with The Spinning Heart. It's this collection of interlinked short stories within a small town where every character only has a certain amount of the truth and you only come to a full understanding by seeing all of their perspectives together. It's beautiful.
Mm. Favorite English teacher or professor and why?
Oh, yeah, Miss Nace back from school in Rome, who gave us everything to read from Nathaniel Hawthorne, which I hated, and I could still do without that, sorry, Miss Nace, to James Baldwin, to Shakespeare, to Virginia Woolf, and who had such passion and excitement for literature that you couldn't help getting swept up in it.
Three writers that you will read just because they wrote it.
Donna Tartt, Michael Chabon, and probably Thomas Keneally.
And a question that we have stolen from Stephen Colbert, but we think is quite illustrative. In five words, just five words, what would you like the rest of your life to be?
Well, long, healthy, happy, and giggly.
Wonderful.
I love it.
Wonderful. Thank you. This has been a treat. Thank you, Tana. I really appreciate it.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, thank you, Tana French. I'm very excited you're here.
You got to love that list of mystery writers that she has. She's obviously a good student and has read widely in her own genre. And that was, what did you just call it?
I said she wrote us a little mini syllabus for aspiring mystery writers everywhere. So week one, Agatha Christie. You take note.
That's true. I mean, that's really a good list, I think. If somebody wants to write a mystery, she's given you each of the different categories of mystery writing and a master at each one of them. Mm. I thought that was really interesting. Anyway, we have a bookstore this week. It is the Odyssey Bookshop in South Hadley, Massachusetts. South Hadley, I know as a former undergraduate, that's the home of Mount Holyoke. That was rich dating territory when I was in college.
That was the land of opportunity for you, as it were?
Yes, all female college. But anyway, we had a conversation with Joan Grenier, who is there in South Hadley. Joan Grenier joins us from the Odyssey Bookshop. She has been running this store. Oh my goodness, you've been more than 30 years you've been running the store, and the store has been in the Grenier family, I gather, for 60 years. Tell me how it started.
Well, we have to talk about my dad first. My dad was an immigrant from Quebec, so his first language is French. My father was never really interested in going back to Quebec, so he had a year of high school, but he loved books. And once he could speak English, he would buy a book a week. He started working in my Irish-American grandfather's drugstore, cleaning the basement. And he eventually, in the 30s, became a pharmacist. He had two or three drugstores at one point. And in 1957, one of them was called Glessman's in South Hadley, across the street from Mount Holyoke College. And he brought books into that drugstore. He started with 500 Penguin Classics. And eventually the college said, you know, would you open a bookstore? We can build you a wing on a building right next door. And he said yes. And that's the founding of the Odyssey in 1963. We're talking an old-fashioned pharmacy with a soda fountain and booths and a counter and gifts. And he always said, well, the books were taking over the aspirin. So I opened a bookstore.
Now, what was your history? When did you start working?
So I worked a little bit through high school. Then kind of off and on, I was a bit of a vagabond in the 70s. I went to Africa and Central America. So when I ran out of money, I would come back and work in the bookstore. Then in 1985, I was taking my GREs to go on in history. And this is back when the GREs were pencil and paper. And you couldn't leave the room until everybody had turned in all their pencils and paper. But at the front of the auditorium, they said that somebody was waiting outside for me. Of course, I'm very nervous. My parents are in their 70s at that point. When I got outside the room, a friend of mine who had taken the GREs the year before came up to me and said, the Odyssey's on fire, but everybody's safe. So when I got there, it was gone. We were attached to a 200-year-old inn, and that's where it started. And then we didn't know what to do, but the college wanted us to, you know, try again. And there was a small empty building, and we went into that building, and the college helped us. The carpenters came over and built shelves. So at that point, I dropped college again, planning to go back. And then May of the next year, I received a call from my dad in the middle of the night, and he told me that the Odyssey was burning. And I told him to go back to bed. You're having a bad dream. And he said, no, I'm here with the president of the college, and it is burning. So at that point, you know, you're never fully insured for total replacement.
Right.
But we did have some insurance. My dad was 76, and he said, you know, I can't do this again. But if you want the insurance money, I don't know if I'm giving you more than headaches. And, you know, my mother had a gift shop, and she had lost the gift shop. So I said, well, I'll do it for a little while. Let's get it back running. And, you know, that was May of 86.
So you've been without a fire since May of 86. Is there some sort of sign recognizing that in the store, fire-free since 1986?
No, but people wanted us to rename as the Phoenix. And we have had two floods and one car drive into the building. But obviously not as bad as a fire. And so South Hadley Center was burnt down. There were multiple businesses burnt each time. So the Congregational Church let us use their church hall. And we were in there, I think, for about 9 months. And then by then, the first building of what's now called the Village Commons was built. And we were the first, you know, store in there.
I worked in a bookstore for about a year and a half. So I always like booksellers to sell us a couple of titles as long as they're here.
Okay. Well, the James McBride book was one of my favorites. Mm. Heaven and Earth Grocery Store. Also, Abraham Verghese has been a favorite of mine for a long time. So Covenant of Water. Mm. We were very fortunate to have Rachel Maddow, and I've read all her books. So Prequel was I think is fantastic about fascism in this country.
Thank you so much. We're really grateful. Thank you.
Well, thank you. It was great to talk to you, and I hope you come visit sometime.
Take care.
Thanks. Our thanks to Joan Grenier. You can find the Odyssey Bookstore on College Street there in South Hadley. Next week, I think we have something really, really special for people, Kate. And this is something that I know your husband David suggested, and I think it's such a great idea. So what is it?
Every once in a while, my husband comes up with a good idea. He married me. Anyway, so he came to me and he said, you know, it has surprised you guys that this podcast has become a masterclass on writing. And every writer in some ways has given us their own little dollop of advice for writers. And so he said, wouldn't it be interesting to get a front row seat for the writing of a book from the mind of a writer from start to finish? And I have a very good friend who is a writer who I went to college with and who is himself a best-selling novelist, J. Ryan Straddle, Kitchens of the Great Midwest, Saturday Night at the Lakeside Supper Club. He's a great, great writer. Lager Queen of Minnesota, another great one. And he's starting his new book. So we're going to sort of get to see him from start to finish. So we'll get to get a sense of like, does page 90, he's like, I don't want to be a writer anymore. By page 120, is he like, I'm the best writer that ever was. Like, what are the habits in his process? And how does he get past all that self-doubt and criticism, self-criticism to turn out what he turns out?
How does it develop? And I think it'll be a really interesting experience to have a writer in residence. And we'll talk to J. Ryan every 6 weeks, 8 weeks, to see how he's proceeding and where his roadblocks are and how he overcomes them and if he gets enthused about his characters. I think it'll be great fun to spend some time with an author as he, in this case, he works through a new book. And as you mentioned, all three of his books so far have been quite successful. The Saturday Night at the Lakeside Supper Club just coming out in paperback. And he's working on a fourth. And how do you balance that with home life? Mm. You know, where do you squirrel yourself away? Where do you find yourself the most productive? At what time of day? Do you need to be alone? Or can his son Auden be running through the room saying, Daddy, Daddy, Daddy? And I don't know. I just think it'll be fun.
Yeah.
And he's a really great talker, J. Ryan. So we hope you'll start with us next week and be with us every week as we, every once in a while, check in with our writer in residence, J. Ryan Straddle.
Yes, we witnessed the genius and the madness that is J. Ryan Straddle. and we are really looking forward to that. A reminder about the folks who make this podcast possible, and then a coda from Ton of French.
The Bookcase is a production of ABC Audio in partnership with Good Morning America. It is produced by David Canada in conjunction with Sure Can Productions. Asal Lasanapour is our producer. Laura Mayer and Simone Swink are our executive producers. We give special thanks to Taylor Rhodes, Amanda McMaster, and Sarah Russell of Good Morning America, and Josh Cohan, Nania McLean, Vika Aronson, and Brenda Salinas Baker at ABC Audio.
If I can say one thing, it's going to be there seems to be a drive from some quarters to portray the arts as this weird elitist indulgence that is only for the middle classes and the out of touch. And that's a dangerous thing because the arts should be for absolutely everybody. This is the way that we gain glimpses into other people's lives. It's the way we develop the sense of empathy. We develop our awareness that other people, other perspectives are as real and as valid and as vital as our own. So the arts, theater, books, music, paintings, these are not some snobbish, meaningless little thing. These are for everybody and they need to keep on being accessible to everybody because they matter.